Hey everybody, welcome to Sound Off 91 here on SCScoops.com. It is Saturday, December 5th, 2009. I am the Solid Monster here with you. And obviously have some pretty horrible news to lead off the podcast. There was no show last week. I apologize for that. I had a bit of an extended stay in Atlantic City for a friend's wedding and just didn't have the time for it. And unfortunately, yesterday was a bad day if you were a wrestling fan or part of the wrestling business in some way. Because, as I'm sure you've heard by now, Eddie Fatu, better known in his WWE days as Umaga, the Samoan Bulldozer, passed away yesterday in Texas at the age of 36. It was kind of a harrowing deal all throughout the day, really. News broke earlier in the afternoon that actually initial reports were that he was already dead. At least one major wrestling news website kind of jumped the gun a little bit on that story and had to backpedal and take the story down. It was not SC Scoops, but it was another website. And then the reports all throughout the day were that he was in a life-threatening way at a hospital in Texas on life support, fighting for his life, basically. And family was being told to rush to the hospital and rush to Texas as quickly as possible, which obviously when you hear something like that, that's usually not a sign of good news to come, and it was not. About 6 o'clock Eastern time, I believe, yesterday evening is when he was officially pronounced dead. The story, as I understand it right now, and I'm sure there'll be more details that come out in the days and weeks ahead, and perhaps even some details that we simply will never know. Eddie was home and watching television and had fallen asleep. And his wife had come in and placed a blanket on him and left the room. A couple of hours later, when she had returned, she found him basically unconscious and with blood coming from his nose. I've also heard that there was blood coming out of his mouth, but that has not been confirmed. But there was blood coming out of his nose. He was not responsive. She called 911. He was rushed to the hospital. Again, I've heard conflicting reports here that when he was found, he was essentially dead or near death, and then they were able to resuscitate him and get some vital signs back in the ambulance. But by the time they got to the hospital, he was pretty much almost gone. Put him on life support. A couple of hours later, the decision was made to take him off life support. And at that point, it was really just a matter of time. And he passed away. Now, Umaga, it's worth noting here, and WWE.com, once everything was confirmed yesterday evening, did put a statement up on their website with condolences to the family, and also mentioning the fact that he was essentially let go by the company and terminated from his contract. I believe the date was June 11th of this year. I know that in June of this year, he was let go after what I believe was his second wellness policy violation. He was told to, or suggested, to go into rehab by WWE. He refused, and WWE fired him. Of course, his version of the story was that he wasn't fired, he quit. Whatever the case was, he was no longer with World Wrestling Entertainment at that point, and did not really do a lot of indie work, I don't think. He was, however, part of the recent Hulkamania tour of Australia, which just wrapped up last week. He competed, I believe, on each of the four nights of the tour. Final night, I believe, was in Sydney, Australia, where he defeated Mr. Anderson, who you may better know in WWE as Mr. Kennedy. Interesting note, if not a bit eerie about that, by the way, is that it appears that Mr. Kennedy has a very dubious claim to fame now in that he was the last person to have a singles match, at least a televised singles match, with Eddie Guerrero before Eddie passed away back in November of 2005. It was a match that was on SmackDown. I don't remember if Eddie wrestled any house show matches after the SmackDown tapings that week, but it's pretty much well known that Eddie's last match was with Kennedy. And now, apparently, Umaga's last match was with Kennedy as well, which can't make Mr. Kennedy feel very good. I'm sure, obviously, it's just a horrible coincidence, but If I was Mr. Kennedy, I would be a little leery about wrestling anybody named Eddie in the future. But Umaga came back from the Australia tour, seemed to be okay. He seemed to be in fine health. In fact, people on the tour thought that he had actually lost a little bit of weight from his WWE days. He was looking good. He was feeling good. And he was a guy that everybody loved based on you know, you look at their Twitter updates from different wrestlers and stories. And even before he died, you know, I'd see pictures all the time posted on Matt Hardy's Twitter of him, you know, of Umaga or Eki, as they called him, hanging out with Matt and Jeff and Hurricane Helms and Shannon Moore. And Lillian Garcia actually posted a really cool picture on her Twitter page yesterday. And you can get access to Lillian's page through my page if you go to twitter.com/Solomonster, because she's one of the people who I follow. She posted a really cool picture that it looks like it's from a plane on the way into one of the Christmas Iraq shows in the last couple of years. And it's a picture that has, you know, Lillian posing with Carlito, with Umaga, with Rey Mysterio, without a mask, by the way. Shawn Michaels and Chris Jericho. It's just a really cool picture. He was a guy that, by all accounts, was just a really good guy. I do know that he had some trouble, or he may have actually been he was released from WWE, if I remember correctly, back from his 3-minute warning days when he was teaming with Rosie, because of some sort of domestic issue where he may have, and I have to go back and check this, but he may have struck his wife. So, you know, look, I'm not going to comment on the guy because I didn't know him personally, but just based on what all the wrestlers and people that did know him and work with him are saying, you know, he was one of the good guys. And in terms of the family of which he is a part, he's part of that whole Samoan family, the Anoa'i family, a family that includes a lot of different people from over the years. Was probably the best worker, the best in-ring worker of any of the family members. For a guy that was as big as he was, and, you know, again, he wasn't as big as somebody like Yokozuna, who was literally 500, 600, 700 pounds at different points of his career. Umaga was never 500 pounds, although he certainly was in that 300 to 350-pound range easily. He was a big guy who moved around like he was a lightweight. And very agile. And a guy who I think could have been a world champion. Absolutely. He certainly could have been. And it's unfortunate that we never got that feud with The Undertaker that for years people talked about pairing Umaga off with The Undertaker. And it just never worked out. At one point, I know Undertaker was scheduled to feud with him, I believe, for the World Heavyweight title on SmackDown. Umaga got hurt and was out for several months. But anyway, just a sad story all around. I can tell you that WWE was not happy about the Hulkamania tour, even more so than the TNA tour of Australia coming up. They could care less about that, but not very happy about the TNA tour, and they were looking to hire some guys away, even before the tour started, to try to get them to kind of cancel out their commitment on Hogan and Bischoff. And one of the guys they were eyeballing and they wanted to bring back into the company was Umaga. So, you know, WWE, I understand why in their statement they would specifically go out of their way to mention the fact that he was fired on this date and he was no longer with the company because they want to protect themselves, and I can't fault them for that. As tacky as it may seem, I cannot fault the company for that. But I find it interesting that there was a very big interest on their part in bringing Umaga back to the company sooner rather than later. And it was obvious, to me anyway, that he was not over whatever issues he had. It's pure speculation at this point, I admit, but let's face facts here. A guy 36 years old who suddenly, you know, has blood coming out of his nose and passes away is a little suspect. Maybe it was some sort of condition that he was born with or something like that. Anything is certainly possible, but when you hear about a guy who was basically let go from a company, when the company did not want to let him go, he was an asset to the company, and they let him go because he failed a wellness test and refused to go to rehab, there's some underlying issue there. Now, there's been different rumors about what it was, that he had some sort of, you know, pain pill addiction. What I can tell you is that it appears he suffered a heart attack and was then brought to the hospital and I believe was taken off life support and then suffered a second heart attack, and that's what killed him. At least those are the reports coming out. that it was one, if not two, heart attacks that ultimately did him in. But what caused him to kind of slip into this condition or have the heart attack in the first place? Was it an overdose? Was it something completely unrelated? It is pure speculation at this point, but it's just another example. You know, draw your own conclusions here. And why wrestlers can't see, why they insist on thinking that things like this can't happen to them is you know, after all of the people under the age of even 30, let alone 40 or 50 that have died over the years, it's mind-boggling to me. You know, that mentality of just kind of soldiering on, just like nothing ever happened. And we just see stories like this time and time again. And really, any time a wrestler passes away in a situation like this, at an age like this, you have to think the worst. And that's the unfortunate thing here, because some people just have heart attacks and die. Did Umaga, maybe because of his weight issues, even if he did lose some weight, obviously he was a heavy guy. Did that have something to do with it? Obviously, you know, you think back to Yokozuna, who obviously is a grossly different example, but Yokozuna obviously let his weight spiral out of control, was on a wrestling tour in England back in 2000 in his hotel room, and he died of a massive heart attack. I can't say that that was all that shocking, but exactly what caused this to happen to Eddie is still a mystery. Obviously, I would imagine we'll find out more in the weeks ahead. It's just a sad situation no matter which way you look at it. And obviously, our thoughts and wishes are with his family. It sucks in these situations to be the family members, whether it's the wife or the kids or the you know, the parents, the relatives, friends, colleagues that he worked with. Even Chris Jericho posted on his Twitter that Eddie was one of the good guys and one of the few guys that he really trusted in the business, and Jericho was devastated. And I'm sure there's a lot of people who feel the same way today. And I would imagine we'll see some sort of graphic or tribute or video or at least hear about this on Raw Monday night. He was a kind of a big star of the modern era. Ironically, he was part of maybe the most profitable WrestleMania match of all time back in 2007, the Battle of the Billionaires, where he fought Bobby Lashley with Vince McMahon in one corner and Donald Trump in the other corner. Easily the biggest match of his career and probably the biggest payoff, too. And you know, it's unfortunate that one of the members of that match now is no longer with us. Now, shifting gears here for a second, because I did not do a show last week, I did not have the opportunity to give my thoughts on the Jesse Ventura edition of Raw from 2 weeks ago. Jesse the Body Ventura brought back to Monday Night Raw, obviously. Jesse, former governor of the state of Minnesota as well. Jesse is one of my all-time favorite characters and announcers in WWE. And in fact, Jesse is probably part of my second favorite announced duo and third favorite announced duo of all time. Because if I had to rank them, I would put Gorilla Monsoon and Bobby Heenan at the top, with Gorilla Monsoon and Jesse Ventura at number two. And I'd probably put Vince McMahon and Jesse Ventura at number three, and Jim Ross and Jerry Lawler at number four. And that by no means is a knock on Jim Ross and Jerry Lawler. And in terms of calling a straight wrestling match, there is nobody better than Jim Ross. But growing up with Monsoon and Heenan and McMahon and Ventura, the chemistry and the comedy between them, and the fact that Jesse was always a straight shooter in wrestling and outside of wrestling. You know, the thing that always cracked me up about Jesse on commentary, for example, is when, even as sort of a heelish announcer, even if he wasn't a full-fledged heel, but you know, basically he kind of was, he had a knack for calling things like they were. If somebody was cheating in the match, he would talk about it. If somebody like Hulk Hogan, the crown prince babyface of the promotion, was eye-raking and eye-gouging people and back-scratching them in the middle of a match, and Jesse would freak out when Vince McMahon, the babyface announcer, would pretend like it was okay, and Jesse would throw a fit. And it was just total comedy that I loved. So when I found out that Jesse was going to be announcing the Breakthrough Battle Royal with Vince McMahon, I nearly peed my pants. I will say that that Raw show from 2 weeks ago was easily, in my opinion, the second best Raw of the entire year. Second for me only behind the Madison Square Garden show the week prior because, well, I was there live. So I may be a little biased in that opinion, although the MSG Raw I thought was a very good show even on its own merits, especially the Randy Orton, Kofi Kingston stuff. But this was just phenomenal stuff. And I don't think if you grew up on this stuff in the 80s and early 90s that you could truly appreciate it for what it was. But to me, this was the second best Raw show of the entire year. Jesse coming out at the beginning of the show, by the way, and preaching that, you know, we're tired of seeing the same guys in the main event over and over again, was awesome. Obviously, you know, he was told to say that, but I think because it's so true, again, it just made Jesse seem different than any other guest host that they've used before. Jesse was easily, if not the best of the guest hosts in the top three. He was awesome. And so when he came out for the Battle Royal and introduced Vince McMahon, and Vince McMahon came out in the old school tuxedo with the bow tie to Obsession by Animotion. And I had a lot of people email me when on my Twitter I mentioned, oh my God, it's Obsession. And people email me and go, well, what's the big deal? That music that Vince McMahon came out to was the original theme music. First of all, it's a legitimate hit song from the 1980s. But it was the original theme song to Saturday Night's Main Event. So quite a throwback there. And I'm sure whenever they make, they're supposedly making a Best of Raw 2009 DVD set, which I kind of joked a couple of weeks ago would be three blank discs. Well, now they finally have something to put on there, although I'm sure if this makes it onto the DVD, they'll have to dub that music out. But Vince comes to ringside, and the thing I love about Jesse also is that he's not afraid of Vince McMahon. I mean, in real life, Vince and Jesse have had numerous clashes that go back many, many years. I mean, when Jesse left the company in the early 90s, in 1990 actually, he sued the World Wrestling Federation over royalties that he felt was due to him from merchandising and video games, and Jesse won. Jesse won, I believe, a million-dollar settlement from the company. But Jesse Ventura is also the reason why wrestlers today are paid royalties on any videos that they appear in, and I believe video games as well. That is purely because of Jesse Ventura. So the wrestlers who get these big checks now from royalties whenever they appear on a DVD, even if it's just in one match, no matter how big or small the check might be, they can thank Jesse Ventura for that. So obviously there was a lot of bad blood for many years with him and Vince McMahon. Jesse did come back for the first time in 1999. This was after he had already won the governorship in the state of Minnesota. Jesse came in at SummerSlam that year to officiate the Triple Threat main event with Stone Cold, Mankind, and Triple H. And he's done a couple of videos here and there over the years for them, but that was really the main kind of involvement that he's had in the modern day generation. So since SummerSlam 10 years ago, this was the first time we're seeing Jesse live and in the arena, and in a WWE ring, and him and Vince McMahon together at ringside. At first, Vince, you know, the thing about Vince McMahon, his voice has obviously changed. It's very, gravelly, and I think all those years of saying, you know, you're fired, and that voice have not done his voice box any favors. But by the end of the Battle Royal, by the middle and end of the Battle Royal, Vince had gotten into it. He was getting into the whole thing. Jesse was great all the way through. I swear to God, I swear, Jesse sounds exactly the same as he did 20 years ago. And it was like I was a kid all over again. And Jesse's not afraid of Vince, in character or out of character. You know, he'll tell McMahon to shut up. He'll disagree with him. Jesse was giving his analysis in the middle of the Battle Royal, and it was a refreshing change from the usual bullshit fake commentary that we get from Michael Cole and Jerry Lawler and everybody else. And again, I can't knock the announcers too much because they're only being told to do what they're told to do, and it's their job to do what the boss wants them to do. But the announcing in WWE these days is so horrible that I really honestly was hoping coming out of the show that they would offer Jesse some sort of deal where at least he can come back for certain pay-per-views and call a match with or without Vince McMahon. Obviously, that's not going to happen, but I loved it. I absolutely loved it, and I really felt like the Battle Royal had a different feel to it just based on the commentary. There was, you know, the Battle Royal itself was nothing special at all. In fact, it was a pretty weak Battle Royal, but just the announcing made it so much different and so much more enjoyable. And hearing, you know, Jesse, for example, give his analysis on how it's going to take more than one person to lift Mark Henry out of the ring, and, you know, you got to be a smart wrestler, McMahon, just like I was back in my day, as opposed to them sitting there and fake talking their, you know, enthusiasm about the main event later in the show or something like that. Really, really good stuff. When Kofi Kingston got tossed over the top rope and held on, and then, of course, head scissored Randy Orton out of the ring. Up until that point, Vince McMahon had picked Randy Orton to win the Battle Royal. And when Orton went over the top rope and was gone, McMahon said, "Nah, Orton's eliminated from the Battle Royal, just as I predicted." And without missing a beat, Jesse came back at him, just yelling in this disgusted tone, you know, "You never said that! Shut up, McMahon!" It was just great. I loved it. And so, big thumbs up on that Raw show. Of course, Jesse turning heel at the end was kind of cool also, but quite a contrast to Raw from this past Monday night with mini-me, Vern Troyer. First of all, I did not realize how small Vern Troyer was. He is a tiny, tiny human being. He made Hornswoggle look like the giant Gonzalez on Raw when they had that one scene together in the back. I thought Vern Troyer was probably the worst guest host they've had. Even Al Sharpton, at least, had some charisma and enthusiasm to him. Vern Troyer contributed nothing to the show at all. Plus, I don't think they plugged anything for him, which was actually kind of cool to have somebody on the show and not, you know, have them on to promote some sort of bullshit DVD. I mean, maybe I missed one of the backstage segments, but he was just there as a fan to host the show, and I thought it was just complete garbage. He didn't contribute anything to the show. He seemed very nervous. And I was almost hoping that The Miz, at one point in that show, would actually kick him through the ring post, almost like a goal field kick in football, but unfortunately he didn't do it. So, as great as I thought Raw was 2 weeks ago, and even 3 weeks ago, I thought Raw last week pretty much sucked. It was not a good show. The guest host sucked. There was nothing overly special on the show. Miz and Mark Henry rapping. I mean, really? Really now? Doesn't do anything for me at all. I was happy to see them ditch the Little People's Court segment until I found out that apparently we're going to get that on Raw this coming Monday in Dallas. On the go-home show to the pay-per-view, no less, when they have to do a hard sell, and DX is involved in what is essentially the main event match on that show, they're going to do a comedy sketch with DX and Hornswoggle. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So yeah, Raw sucked last week, and Raw this coming Monday night has Mark Cuban as the guest host. Mark Cuban, of course, the owner of the Dallas Mavericks, and he also owns and operates the HDNet cable channel, which is interesting because HDNet is chock full of mixed martial arts programming, but it's also host to Ring of Honor. Ring of Honor airs their TV show weekly on HDNet, which is interesting. So, you know, I think it would be kind of cool, if anything, if maybe Cuban comes out on Monday night and introduces a new member of the Raw roster, and out comes Bryan Danielson, former Ring of Honor champion. That would be kind of cool, even though Danielson would be completely the wrong fit for the Raw brand, but it's just a waiting game with him at this point. Danielson is under contract at WWE. He's on payroll. He's getting paid, so it's just a matter of when they're ready for him to make his television debut. They did promise him that he would bypass developmental and go right to TV, so it's just a matter of, I think, when at this point. I would say that he would be a great fit for the ECW brand, even though ECW is kind of the bastard brand, and I don't really watch it much. But he, you know, ECW, you'll have a better chance to have those longer 10 to 15 minute long matches. Whereas I think if Danielson is on Raw, let's say, for example, it would be the absolute worst place for him. Because having 2 and 3 minute matches is not going to do him any good. He's not exactly the most charismatic guy in the world. I think he can really get over with the fans initially by showing them what he can do in the ring. ECW is probably not going to be the best place for him anyway, because ECW, if you have not heard, and I know I'm going off topic here for a second, but ECW as a brand apparently will cease to exist as of January of 2010. WWE will still have a show on Sci-Fi, but it will be a completely different show with a completely different name. The ECW name will officially be retired once and for all. And there's talk of changing the entire format of the show, maybe making it a show where there is nobody but young up-and-coming guys, almost like SCW on Sci-Fi. So that'll be very interesting to see what happens in the weeks ahead. So I just wanted to throw that out there. But back on the Mark Cuban point, he will be hosting Raw. He is a big wrestling fan. And if you haven't seen it, or if you don't remember, Survivor Series back in 2003 emanated from Dallas, Texas, and Mark Cuban was a guest and even did an angle in the ring. I believe he was confronting the Raw general manager at the time, Eric Bischoff, when Randy Orton ran down to the ring and gave Cuban an RKO. And so it sounds like that may play into the show on Monday night. It was a newspaper article, I believe in one of the Texas papers I saw online a couple of days ago, where Cody Rhodes of Legacy was issuing a challenge to Mark Cuban to a match. So Cuban may actually wrestle a match, or at least they may tease a match between Cuban and Legacy on Raw Monday night. So it'll be interesting. I'm sure it'll be better than the Vern Troyer show. And it's the go-home show before the TLC pay-per-view. They're going to have to get people to they're going to have to convince people to spend their money on TLC. And they're pushing DX against Jericho for the tag team titles in what I believe is the only TLC match on the pay-per-view. Essentially, that's going to be the main event of the show. And, again, I question whether having DX do comedy crap with Hornswoggle on this final Raw before the pay-per-view is the wisest move to make. Of course, we are going to have a handicap match, Triple H and Shawn Michaels against Chris Jericho. Completely ass-backwards booking here. Why you would have the two babyfaces outnumber the heel, I don't know. The only thing I can guess, Big Show had arthroscopic knee surgery like a week and a half ago. It's just nuts that he's already back wrestling. He claims that he feels great, but to come back that quickly, especially when you're a big guy who's had knee operations before, to come back from knee surgery within a week or two is just lunacy. And so maybe Big Show's not exactly feeling as good as he should, and they knew that, and therefore did not want to put him in the match on Monday night and give him more time to heal up before the pay-per-view. That's about the only thing I can guess, because why you would put Jericho in there alone against both members of DX is beyond me, but... that's the match that we're going to get on Monday night. And, you know, for the pay-per-view, I have to say, it was really questionable to have Triple H come out on Raw Monday night and basically admit that they don't give a shit about the tag team titles. I think that Jericho and Big Show, you know, after Edge went down, Big Show became his partner, they've done a really good job these last 4 months of building those belts up to mean something. And to have Triple H come out and essentially say, you know, we got this tag title match on pay-per-view that's basically the main event, and we don't really give two shits about winning the belts. We just want to beat you so that Chris Jericho doesn't appear on Raw anymore. I don't understand why you would say that. I really don't. We all know that Triple H probably could care less about being a tag team champion, but you don't come out and admit that on TV when you're trying to promote a title match on pay-per-view. So, I don't know how well TLC is going to do. That's being positioned as the main event match. You've got John Cena defending the championship against Sheamus. Now, little sidebar here. WWE just came back from Iraq. They just taped their Tribute to the Troops show, I believe, on Friday. And the spoilers for the show are online, and I may have a little bit of a spoiler here, so if you don't want to see this, you might want to skip ahead. But on the show, which is going to air December 19th on NBC, I believe it's a one-hour special that will air at about, I think, 9 o'clock Eastern on NBC on December 19th, John Cena wrestles, and he comes out with the championship belt. Now, mind you, this show will air after the TLC pay-per-view. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean anything. I mean, I suppose there are ways around that. But if they knew that Cena was going to lose the belt at the pay-per-view, I imagine they would not have him coming out and parading around all over the place with the belt on a show that's going to air after TLC. So it may be a bit of a spoiler. And quite frankly, you know, if it is a sign of the outcome of that match at the pay-per-view, it's not all that surprising, and I think it's the right move. I am as sick as many of you are of seeing John Cena as the WWE champion. But the fact is, I give them all the credit in the world for the Sheamus push. I am behind it because it's somebody new. I give WWE kudos for that. The fact is that Sheamus is not ready. It's arguable if Sheamus is even ready to be in a pay-per-view main event, but Sheamus is not at all ready to be a world champion. And if he wins the belt in a swerve at the pay-per-view, let's see where they go with it. But I don't think Sheamus is winning the belt, nor do I think he should at this point. I think Sheamus being in the main event is a good move because it's somebody different than Triple H or Shawn Michaels or Randy Orton. And I'm all for it. I give them a lot of credit for it. And I think, you know, there is the potential there for Cena and Sheamus to have a really good match. You know, it may be a crappy match or it may not be a crappy match. But it would appear, based on these Tribute to the Troops results, that Cena will probably walk out of the pay-per-view with the belt. And you know what? If they build up to a rematch, maybe at the Royal Rumble between the two of them, that would be fine. I don't know that they're going to want to go in that direction. If Cena and Sheamus have a poor showing on pay-per-view, they've got 7 weeks to build to the Royal Rumble, they may decide, you know what, we're going to go in a different direction. But I'm willing to wait and see how things play out. And before, you know, a lot of people are casting off this match. They're saying, you know, Sheamus isn't ready. He's not good in the ring. This is going to be garbage. Let us not forget. Let's go back to 2005 here for a moment. When John Cena won the WWE Championship for the first time, indeed it was a dark day, but he won the belt at WrestleMania 21, which was back in 05, from JBL. And I remember vividly, this was a WrestleMania Championship match. Granted, they did not go on last. Triple H and Batista ended the show, but this is your WWE Championship match at WrestleMania, and it was, first of all, it was shockingly brief, but it was such a horrible match. I mean, it wasn't, by no means was it the worst match I've ever seen, but it was a bad match. And 2 months later, JBL and Cena came back with the main event of Judgment Day in May, and they had an I Quit match for the WWE title that, as I recall, was an awesome match. It was so much better than it had any right to be. They brawled all over the building. They beat the hell out of each other. They bled. There was a lot of blood in the match. It's amazing what some color can really can do for a match. And JBL, when he could take no more at the end, was basically begging off and just said, I quit, I quit, I quit. And it was a great, great match. So, you know, two people that you don't think are the best fit for each other may end up having such great chemistry that you just want to see them wrestle over and over and over again. I'm not saying that what happened with Cena and JBL is going to be the same thing as Cena and Sheamus, but I'm willing to give the match a chance. I'm not expecting Sheamus to get the belt this soon, but it's something different. And so that's your WWE Championship match at the pay-per-view. Undertaker will put the World Heavyweight title on the line in a chairs match against Batista. Of course, the rules of a chairs match have not been explained to us yet. But there you go. Christian, in what may be the show stealer, will face Shelton Benjamin in a ladder match for the ECW Championship. I'm looking forward to that one. That'll be cool. And John Morrison will put the Intercontinental title on the line in apparently what will be a straight wrestling match against Drew McIntyre. It would not surprise me to see McIntyre, who is one of the chosen few, along with Sheamus, win the belt. But we shall see. So those are the matches I think that have so far been announced for TLC. On paper, you know, it's not the strongest show they've put on. It's not a horrible lineup. I don't know how well it's going to do on pay-per-view. I think it'll do okay. You know, looking back at some of the pay-per-view numbers that have been released, WWE has already scrapped the submission pay-per-view concept that they used for Breaking Point in September because the pay-per-view did horribly. I think it came in at about 175,000 pay-per-view buys, which is not good, and was down from Unforgiven. But the Hell in a Cell pay-per-view in October did in the range of 300,000 pay-per-view buys, which is actually really good. Bragging Rights did about 200,000, which is okay, but it was still better than No Mercy, so those two concepts are going to return next year. This being the first time they're using TLC as a gimmick pay-per-view, much like Hell in a Cell, I think it has the potential, maybe not 300,000 pay-per-view buys, but I think it has the potential to do pretty well. The question is, you know, when you bring TLC back next year and the year after that and the year after that, how will it perform? But I think it'll do well enough. I guess we'll find out in due time. Want to mention some TNA stuff here. The January 4th date, which I've given here on this podcast before, appears to be the date that Hulk Hogan will appear in TNA for the first time. I know he will be in Orlando on January 4th, which is a Monday. Now, it's still no clearer than it was a couple of weeks ago whether or not this will be a one-time-only live Monday special for TNA that will air on Spike, or, as I believe, it will simply be the usual Monday night taping of Impact that will air that Thursday. I believe it will be a Monday night taping that will air on Thursday, but again, I don't know this for sure. I also don't know for sure at this point if Hulk Hogan will actually be appearing live on TV in the Impact Zone. Hogan has a lot of people in his ear telling him that, look, you don't want to be seen, at least not yet, in this little shitty arena. You know, because people are going to look at you in this little tiny thing and it's going to make you look bad. So I don't know if Hogan will actually be on TV in the Impact Zone on January 4th. He is supposed to be there. One way or the other, the new era for TNA, for Total Nonstop Action Wrestling, will kick off on January 4th. And one of the rumors going around is that Hulk Hogan wants to get rid of the six-sided ring. Now, I admit the six-sided ring does give TNA a bit of a unique identity, but I have never been a fan of the six-sided ring. So if Hogan came in and said, look, we're getting rid of this thing and we want a regular standard four-sided wrestling ring, I would be completely okay with that. I know a lot of people like it and they would be pissed off if that happened, and you know, you'd have to, you wouldn't be able to do six sides of steel anymore. You'd have to call it something else. But I was just personally never a fan of the six-sided ring. So if this is true and Hogan does come in and get rid of it, and I don't know that that's going to happen right away, I'd actually be okay with that. Nothing terribly new to report on the Rob Van Dam or Ric Flair front. I personally believe that Rob Van Dam and Ric Flair will be in TNA. Van Dam has definitely had discussions with them, but nothing's been signed. Ric Flair has had very, very loose discussions with people associated with TNA, but has not had any direct talks. Flair gave an interview with a website for the first time, expressed a potential interest in going to TNA, because clearly Flair is frustrated that WWE basically cut him off and doesn't have any plans to use him. And so Flair's mindset is, look, if they're not going to use me, and I don't have a non-compete clause anymore that's in effect, I'm going to go where the money is. Hulk Hogan's going to TNA, I might go with him. So I think Flair is definitely going to end up in TNA. It's just a matter of when, not if at this point. And by the way, for those of you who have not checked the Shop TNA video that was posted on YouTube, TNA did this 4-minute long comedy video to promote Shop TNA and their merchandise. And it really is very, very funny. I will give them a lot of credit for this. This is like, at certain points, laugh out loud funny. And it's worth noting that Vince Russo was not the writer of this skit. It was actually Don West and somebody else whose name escapes me that wrote it and put the whole thing together. So kudos to Don West and his partner on putting together something that was genuinely entertaining. My favorite parts of it, quite frankly, my favorite part was Suicide with the Santa hat on his head on the phone with a woman who obviously is more interested in phone sex than ordering any sort of TNA merchandise, and she asks him if he's hot. And Suicide goes, am I hot? Of course I'm hot. You ever try wearing one of these things? And just Suicide voice actually worked in this skit. It was hilarious. I loved it. It was great. And Abyss wrapping the gifts in barbed wire for the little kids, that was just really, really good stuff. If WWE was going to copy anything off of TNA, I'd copy that. I think if they can get some wrestlers rounded up for something like that, that would be pretty cool. So kudos to them on that. Now, something I noticed actually this morning, just before I went to air here with the podcast, taking this here from a story directly from ESPN.com, and the reason it's a boxing story, and the reason I bring this up, it has a direct tie to wrestling for two reasons. Number one, it involves a former WrestleMania main eventer and guest host of Raw. Of course, I'm talking about Floyd Money Mayweather. Apparently, it's not a done deal, but it's looking more and more likely like there will be a Floyd Mayweather-Manny Pacquiao boxing fight on March 13th. I believe that's a Saturday. Actually, let me check that right now. Usually these things are on a Saturday night. I'm guessing it's March 13th. Yes, it is. March 13th. It's a Saturday night. And Pacquiao and Mayweather are probably pound for pound the two best boxers in the world right now. And if this fight were to happen, this would easily be the biggest boxing fight in 20 or 30 years. And has great, great potential to become the highest grossing pay-per-view event of any kind in history. Now, this is significant, not just because Mayweather is involved, but more so because of the date and the timing of it. Now, just looking at the story here, and again, this comes from ESPN.com. The story here says that Manny Pacquiao has signed a contract to fight Floyd Mayweather Jr. in boxing's biggest fight on March 13th. Pacquiao and promoter Bob Arum met for 2 hours on Friday to discuss the proposed deal. Let's see here. Became a done deal later on Friday when Manny signed the paperwork. And the source also indicated that the fight would take place at the welterweight limit of 147 pounds for Pacquiao's title and match the two top fighters in the world pound for pound. The camps agreed to a 50-50 split of the money, which could be gargantuan. Many experts expect the fight to eclipse the all-time pay-per-view record for sales, which is the 2.44 million buys generated by Mayweather's 2007 victory over Oscar De La Hoya. What's interesting about this is March 13th, I believe, is just 2 weeks before WrestleMania 26. I believe WrestleMania next year is on March 28th in Glendale, Arizona. And there is no doubt at all that if this fight takes place, this is going to take a fairly sizable chunk of the buys away from WrestleMania next year. This cannot make WWE or Vince McMahon happy at all. I mean, the only thing they could hope for at this point is that Floyd Mayweather is such a worker and such a big WWE fan that he'll do Vince McMahon a solid and back out of the fight or delay the fight for a couple of months. The reason this fight, by the way, is going to be taking place if Mayweather signs, and that's the key here, Mayweather has not signed, Pacquiao has. If the fight takes place on March 13th as scheduled, the reason it will be taking place then and not in May, for example, which was what the promoters really wanted, so they would have the maximum amount of time to promote the fight, is that apparently Pacquiao is running for some sort of government position, some sort of congressional seat in his native Philippines. And the elections are in May, and obviously a fight in May would conflict with that. So they're having the fight in March so that he can run for election in May and not have it conflict with anything. So if this goes through, if Mayweather signs and this fight takes place, this is bad, bad, bad news for WrestleMania. Because even with a good economy, let alone an economy that's not so good, you cannot expect people to shell out $50 or $60 for a pay-per-view boxing fight and then shell out $50 or $60 for WrestleMania 2 weeks later. Especially if in the WrestleMania cards overall these last couple of years have not been very strong. Typically you'll have one, maybe two matches as your marquee matches, but the WrestleMania cards from start to finish, top to bottom, these last couple of years on paper have not been very strong. I mean, last year, or rather this year, it was a one-match show. It was Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker. WrestleMania 24, you had Mayweather against Big Show. They were pushing as the big attraction. For me, it was a one-match show. Shawn Michaels and Ric Flair. WrestleMania 23 was all about the Battle of the Billionaires. You know, Vince McMahon and Donald Trump, Bobby Lashley and Umaga. WWE is going to have to put together a hell of a card if they want to try to fend off some of these people that may buy the boxing pay-per-view instead. I don't think they're going to – I think they'll be powerless against it if this fight is signed for March 13th, and that's just bad news for them because some people would say, well, the audiences don't overlap. They do overlap. Believe me, they do. If this fight takes place, you're going to get all the boxing people and plenty of wrestling and probably plenty of MMA people as well. Believe me, UFC can't be happy about this either, that are going to buy that boxing pay-per-view. And people who spend, let's say, $55 or $60 on that Mayweather-Pacquiao fight – are not going to turn around and spend the same kind of money for WrestleMania. WrestleMania is the one WWE pay-per-view of the year that costs, I believe, $54.95. They increase the price for WrestleMania each year because it is, of course, like their Super Bowl, and so they charge more money for it. That's just going to work against them this year. And the HD feed in certain areas may be north of $60. Now, before that moron writes in again, who emailed me a month or two ago complaining that, you know, I'm throwing out these $60 figures that don't exist for pay-per-views. For WrestleMania, it's a little bit different because the standard price for WrestleMania does go up over $50, and in some places in this country, the HD feed is $10 more than the standard feed. Now, not here in New York, for example, on Cablevision, which is my cable provider, they charge the same rate for standard showings as they do for HD. But I know for a fact that there are plenty of cable companies in this country, in different parts of the country, who charge $5 or $10 more for the HD feed. So, anyway, the point is, if this fight takes place, and it's all on Mayweather at this point, if he signs on the dotted line, that's going to be bad, bad news for World Wrestling Entertainment as far as WrestleMania 26 buy rate is concerned. One other quick note here I want to just mention before I break into some mailbag stuff. For those of you who have WWE 24/7 on demand, and if you don't and it's available in your area, then you really should at least pay for it for at least 1 month. It really is a great service. For example, this month, there's a brand new Legends Roundtable hosted by Joey Styles. I believe the panel also includes Jim Ross, Jimmy Garvin, Michael P.S. Hayes, and J.J. Dillon. And the subject this month are wrestling managers and some of the greatest managers in wrestling history. Of course, wrestling managers are a lost art form in today's world, thanks in large part to WWE. I do love Don West and TNA as Amazing Red's manager, even though I don't think TNA is doing nearly as much as they could and should with Don West. But it's a great, great episode. You should check it out. But what's interesting is that I believe until Wednesday, it's been up now for about a week, it'll be posted and rotated out of the schedule on Wednesday. So you've got a couple more days to check it out. There is a house show that is currently posted from Madison Square Garden, January 31st, 1992. The opening match pits the Texas Tornado, Kerry Von Erich, against the model Rick Martel. Now, first of all, as a card, it's obviously, I mean, it's not a very good show. It does have Gorilla Monsoon and Bobby Heenan on commentary at ringside, so for that reason alone, you should watch. There's a Bret Hart Undertaker match on here, Macho Man versus Jake the Snake at the peak of their feud, and there's also a lot of garbage on here. You know, Hercules against the Warlord and the Nasty Boys against whoever it was. I don't remember. But what's interesting is that I would say check out the opening match if nothing else, because I watched this match and just could not believe what I was seeing. Kerry Von Erich is the babyface, and he comes out to the ring in the opener. So Von Erich is curtain jerking here. And so he comes out to the ring, and he's being typical Kerry Von Erich. He's smiling, and he's slapping hands, going around ringside. Now he's kissing little kids. You know, he's giving a little girls kisses on the cheek, and now he's kissing little boys, which I know sounds awful, but that's what he's doing. He's kissing all the little kids at ringside. Okay, fine. Looks a little weird to me. He looks like he's a little off balance. Climbs the turnbuckles to pose a little bit. At one point, almost fell off the turnbuckle. Stumbling around a little bit. By this point, I'm wondering to myself, I'm thinking, is this guy drunk? He must be drunk. Maybe he's high on something. We all know Kerry had his vices in life. But, you know, maybe he's just being a typical babyface, typical Kerry Von Erich. So the model comes out for the match. And there's a lot of stalling going on. I mean, Kerry goes back outside of the ring. Now he's slapping hands and talking to the fans more. He grabs somebody's sign, brings it into the ring, holds it up for the cameras to see. The sign says, "Arrogance smells like Raid." Arrogance, of course, was Rick Martel's fragrance. And he brought this device to the ring that he called the Atomizer, and he would spray it in people's eyes. And okay, ha ha ha. So Kerry goes and puts the sign. He lays the sign, or tries anyway, to lay the sign flat on the turnbuckle in the corner, and of course, it falls off, ultimately. And the model goes outside, rips up the sign, gets back in the ring. All right, now we're ready for a match. More stalling. And Kerry just looks, I don't know, he looks like he's a little warped in the head. So they lock up, finally. And Martel gives him a very basic arm drag takedown, and Kerry, and this is the point where I realize that this guy is definitely drunk or high on something. Like, I wasn't sure at first, but at this point, I knew. Kerry proceeds, in the midst of taking this arm drag, to fall directly on his head. It was the most horribly botched arm drag you'll ever see. And the camera zooms in on his face at one point, because now Kerry is on his knees in the ring, hands on hips, like he can't believe what just happened. And the camera puts a shot of his face on the screen, and I'm looking at this guy, I'm looking right in his eyes, and he, you know, it's comical and sad all at the same time. This guy is definitely fucked up on something in this match. And it just boggles my mind that nobody in the back saw this, and they allowed him to come out here for this match. Because allowing him to come out here for this match in front of the crowd is bad enough, but if I'm Rick Martel, I'm pissed off. Because who would want to work with somebody like this? Would you trust somebody in that sort of state, in that sort of condition, to come out here and work with you and be body slamming you around and picking you up and throwing you around? Anyway, Kerry goes on to stall even more. He goes out of the ring, he comes back in, he goes out of the ring. At one point, Rick Martel just got pissed off and went outside, gave him a double axe from behind and threw him in the ring. They proceeded to have what was basically a horrible match, in large part because of Von Erich, which Martel won by putting his feet on the ropes in what looked like a sort of botched finish, not surprising. But Kerry Von Erich, if you want to watch a man on drugs or alcohol wrestle a match, if you can even call it wrestling, Watch this match. It's sad, but it's entertaining all at the same time. It's a boring match, but it's entertaining. It's boring in an entertaining way. I just could not believe that they allowed him to go to the ring. That nobody saw him and knew that he was in that condition, and they allowed him to go out and perform that way. And now we're watching it on video, you know, 15, 16, 17 years later, is just amazing to me. And it really clicked with me, you know, after watching this, because it really was, it was about a year later, I guess, that Kerry committed suicide. But Kerry Von Erich was not a good wrestler. He really was not. And there's a lot of people that would say, well, you know, he was a good wrestler, but, you know, it's not his fault he was on drugs. No, Kerry Von Erich was just not a good wrestler. He is one of the more overrated performers, in my opinion, in wrestling history. He got the big push as the member of that family, and obviously a lot of members of that family died young. Kerry is the one who made it big, went to WWF in 1990, became the Intercontinental Champion. Of course, he lost the belt 3 or 4 months later, but he was just not a good wrestler. Now, one of his famous, if not his most famous match, or matches, were in the mid-80s in World Class with Nature Boy Ric Flair. Well, guess what? Anybody in the ring back then with Ric Flair was probably going to look pretty good. Ric Flair can make a broomstick look good back then. You know, Ric Flair now, at the age of 60, may be a better wrestler than Kerry Von Erich was, you know, towards the end of his career. And that, you know, I understand Kerry had the motorcycle accident in, I think, 87 or 88, and was wrestling with a, basically had to have his foot amputated and was wrestling with a prosthetic, but, you know, that doesn't mean anything to me because Zach Gowen on one leg is a better wrestler than Kerry Von Erich was. So it really clicked here to me. Obviously, he was obviously in an inebriated state, so he was even worse. But Kerry Von Erich was just not. People look back and they say, wow, what a great wrestler he was, especially when he was younger. He really wasn't a great wrestler at all. He really wasn't. It was really just a lot of smoke and mirrors. And he only got worse as the years went on because he was addicted to drugs and, you know, and stuff like that. And ultimately, it did him in. But Kerry Von Erich, just not a very good wrestler at all. Not one of the greatest Intercontinental Champions of all time. Let's just put it that way. All right, enough disrespecting the dead here. Let's break into the mailbag. I've answered a lot of questions directly, but I'm going to try to pick out some of the better ones here with the time we have left. Just give me a moment here. Let's see what we have. Let's see here. Dear Solomonster, do you think anyone will ever call Hulk Hogan on the fact that his recent estrangement from Vince McMahon is from his own doing? Did he not reveal the potential 2007 Hall of Fame inductees on the air on the Bubba the Love Sponge radio show while he was drunk? Specifically, he had Johnny Ace's secretary unknowingly on speakerphone as she read off the names, much to Vince McMahon's disdain. Yes, that did happen, and it has absolutely nothing to do with any sort of estrangement that Vince may have with Hogan. As a matter of fact, Vince McMahon personally called Hulk Hogan a couple of weeks before the Madison Square Garden Raw a couple of weeks ago. This was also before the Hogan TNA announcement was made, because they wanted Hogan in as the guest host for Raw. So Hogan and McMahon have had a lot of different issues over the years, but they always kiss and make up, and they had already kissed and made up. They were going to be back in business had Hogan not gone to TNA. So, you know, it's one of those stories of Vince getting pissed off at Hogan, putting Hogan on his shit list. And I'm sure within a couple of months after that, you know, everything had blown over. Hulk's had one or two DVDs made of his career since then. And like I said, he would have been back on TV a couple of weeks ago had he not signed with TNA. So that really doesn't have anything at all to do with it. Got a report on one of the Hulkamania nights from the tour. I believe it was the Hulkamania Melbourne night from Dando. And I won't go through the entire review, but just skipping ahead to the Hogan-Flair match. He says that Hogan-Flair was both enjoyable and sad. At some points, you felt a chill fill the arena as Hogan struggled around the ring. I thought it was interesting that when his knee brace got caught up in the ropes early on in the match, and since he couldn't tie it back up, he simply threw it to a fan at ringside to a major pop. However, a couple of minutes later, the ring announcer came around and confiscated it from the fan to major heat. But he seemed to enjoy it. Pretty good show. Gave it a 7 out of 10. And still cannot work out why the merchandise was calling Hulk Hogan's mustache the FU. Well, maybe it's the Fu Manchu. I don't know. That's a good question, actually. But we all know if you listen to what Hulk Hogan's been saying in some of these radio interviews, he and John Cena are best friends. Hell, he was probably having Thanksgiving dinner at John Cena's house, if Hulk Hogan is to be believed. Anyway, I'll give a quick plug here to the Michael and Dando show. You could search for it probably on Google. They have their own show. They're actually giving out $1,000 as a competition. I don't know if they've already done that or not, but check out the Michael and Dando show. I know he is an avid follower of the podcast, and so I appreciate that and give him the free plug. See here. Did Paul Orndorff badmouth the WWE Hall of Fame after he was inducted? I don't remember a specific incident, but I believe he may have made comments to that effect. I don't know. He comes off to me as being somewhat bitter for some reason. Even that night at the Hall of Fame, there's something about his demeanor that just seemed a little cold and a little stiff to me. I know he was a little cold and stiff to Hogan. Not a big fan of Hulk Hogan, but I can't point to any specific incident or interview. I can't help but think that he did make some comments to that effect at some point, but I don't have the evidence to substantiate that. All right, we're running a little short on time here. I'll just take one more letter here. Dear Solid Monster, last night I watched the rise and fall of WCW, and I've seen some great matches, but one really did catch my eye. There were two rings put together with a Hell in a Cell-like cage. It featured WCW against the NWO. Great match, but my question is, why in the hell would Vince McMahon not continue matches like this? I know it was a WCW creation, but doesn't Vince own all of that stuff that they did, so why not use it? Also, I would like to propose another Raw drinking game, similar to the Noah Mark Raw drinking game from MSG a couple weeks ago. Every time you hear Michael Cole say the word vintage, take a few shots. Keep on rocking. Thanks, Solid Monster. Well, the match that you're talking about is called War Games, and I've been advocating that they use this concept now for years. Even Triple H, behind the scenes, who was a big fan of the old NWA, has tried to lobby for War Games over the years, but Vince McMahon refuses to use a WCW creation. That's why we got kind of the bastardized version of it with the Elimination Chamber, which now has its own pay-per-view, and so all the more reason I think we will not be seeing War Games anytime soon. And as for your little Raw drinking game, I have to say that, you know, if I were to take, as you said, a few shots, now you don't specify a few shots of what, of course you could be talking about a few shots of vodka, a few shots of Patron. But if I were to take a few shots every time Michael Cole said the word vintage, then you may as well just go ahead and just prepare my tombstone, because my time on this earth will likely come to an abrupt end. And I don't think you want that, because then the sound off would cease to exist. So I think I'll lay off the alcohol. I'll save my alcohol binges for Friday nights and for the weekend. Thank you very much. Speaking of weekends, I should mention that my trip to Atlantic City was very, very enjoyable. The wedding itself was very nice, and what I enjoyed most about it, oh my god, excuse me, my god, I'm still suffering here, in case you can't tell, with my throat, oh boy. Anyway, what was I going to say? Oh yes, I am not a big gambler, and I think that's mainly just because I had never been to Atlantic City, and I still actually have never been to Las Vegas, but I decided on the day that I was going home that I would stop in at one of the casinos. And so I drove, you know, we passed Trump Plaza, site of WrestleMania's 4 and 5. That was really cool. Parked in the parking garage of Caesars and decided that I was going to go in and check out this casino on the inside. Somehow I ended up at a completely different part of the building. I think I ended up in Bally's, and I ended up at this casino called the Wild Wild West Casino, which actually looked really lame to me. Now, maybe that was just because I was going at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, so there wasn't exactly a lot of activity. You've got, obviously, rows and rows of coin machines and slot machines, and, you know, they have the roulette table and poker and all that. Not too many people over there. So I look around. I'm not overly impressed. I decide, all right, you know what? I've seen all that there is to see. I'm going to head out. And as I'm walking out, I notice to my right that there is a video poker room. Now, I play video poker. I have a little handheld game that I used to play for years. I think I still must have it somewhere. I can't tell you how handy that game came in for me when I was waiting in doctor's offices and things of that nature. And so I, you know, I've played video poker before. It's kind of addicting, and I like to think I was pretty good at it. So I said, what the hell? I'll sit down. I'll play one of these machines. So I pick a nickel machine. Might have been a quarter. I'm going to say it was a nickel machine. And I put in $5, and I sit down, and I play. And I'm playing, and I'm racking up points, and I'm racking up, or credits, as they call them. And I got 10 credits now. I'm up to 25 credits. Now I got, two pair. So now I'm up to, like, 40 credits. So at this point, I decide to cash out, and I get a ticket for $11.25. So I made a $6 profit or so off my $5. Not bad. So my brother says, oh, come on, keep playing. Put the ticket back in the machine and see how much more you can get. Obviously, this is why people fall into debt, but I figure whatever. We're not dealing with a lot of money here, so why not? So I put it back in the machine, and I'm knocking them dead. I get 40 credits. I'm up now to 60 credits. Oh, another two pair. Straight, whatever I was getting, I was hitting on all cylinders, and I made my way all the way up to 90 credits. And I said to myself, I really would love to try to get to 100. So, of course, the minute I said that, I'm playing, and now I'm losing. I'm losing bad. And I go all the way down from 90 credits back down to 10, and then boom, I'm done. So now I'm pissed off, and I'm like, let's get the hell out of here. My brother's like, whoa, hold on a second. I want you to play that machine over there. And he points over to a double joker machine, which is basically, it's a video poker machine, but it's like a different kind of game. And he's like, just take your ticket, and or what's left anyway of it. Actually, I'm sorry, I did not use the ticket when I played a second game and lost, because for whatever reason it wasn't taking the ticket, so I just put more money in. So I still had my ticket for $11.25. And he said, go to the double joker machine over there, just sit down, put the ticket in, and just play. Now, I wasn't aware when I sat down that it was it was a $5 machine. It wasn't like a quarter machine or a nickel machine. And so it takes my ticket, and it basically tells me I have two credits or two spins. So now I'm pissed. Why did you tell me to do this? Now, in my head, I lost my $11. So I hit spin, and sure enough, on my first turn, I get three of a kind. Three fours, right in the middle. Boom, 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 like Kofi Kingston. And at that point, I said, that's it. I'm done. I don't know how much I won. I'm cashing out. I cash out. Ticket comes out of the machine. I look at the ticket, and I am amazed. My jaw drops. The ticket says $80. Obviously, my brother is pissed off. I'm happy. I gave him a dollar out of the goodness of my heart, got my $80, and got the fuck out of there. So let that be a lesson to all of you. If you ever go to Vegas, if you ever go to Atlantic City, if you hit it big, and I don't mean big like $100,000 or $1 million, but if you win a little bit of money, quit while you're ahead, because that money is going to disappear if you keep playing. That's how they lure you in. I had to fight off the demons, and I got my $80. And I went and I spent it on the outlets over there in Atlantic City, and then I went home. All in all, it was a fun day. I won $80. Can't complain. And, so if you have a chance to go, play video poker. It's a lot of fun. Emails. TheSolomonster@gmail.com, as always, is the email address. Of course, you can follow me on Twitter and leave me replies there as well. Twitter.com/Solomonster. If you're not already following me on Twitter, then you're way behind the times here. Get with the program. And you can download the show, as always, through the iTunes Music Store. You can subscribe, have it automatically delivered to you whenever a new show is posted. It's all kinds of cool. So definitely check that out. So that's going to do it for episode 91. I want to thank all of you for listening and following me on Twitter and everything else that you guys do to support the show. I really appreciate it. We'll be back next week with episode 92. Hopefully we'll be able to lead off with news that is a little bit happier than we led off with this week. And that's going to do it. So until next time, be well, stay safe, and we'll see you right back here next week. Take it easy, guys.
You've been listening to The Solomonster.
I really just don't understand what they're doing.
Anybody agree with me out there? I mean, anybody. Come on, throw me a bone here.
Probably the single dumbest thing I've ever seen in my entire life.
God, I love this business.
On SE Scoop.